But before I do that, I'd just like to say that Bill's papers have been remarkable in that they are synthesis papers. I mean, I think Bill is an empirical observer of nature, and therefore he sees things probably that nobody else sees. But he's able to synthesize, and this is a great talent that we don't spend enough time teaching our students to be able to do. And I realized much too late in my career that I hadn't been getting students to synthesize information, write reviews, and more than just review the literature, to be creative about what you find in a mass of literature. And I think Bill has been superb at that, and the papers that Ken mentioned initially are papers that I've cherished throughout my career, starting with Mattson and Addy, going through the nitrogen review in 1980 to the drought papers in 96, I think, 98 with Robert Hark, even to the European crucible, which I think is an incredible pair of papers with Peck and Niemela that every student should read, taking pure immigration data of insects moving to Europe and from moving from Europe to North America and the other way around. The last paper about the crucible in terms of resisting insect immigration from North America to Europe was just last year. These are wonderfully creative papers from just a list of empirical information on which species have arrived in which continent. So we have a lot to learn from Bill's work, and I will always think of these papers as some of the great reading that I have done over the last 50 or 60 years. That's a little exaggeration, but I'm prone to that anyway. So what I'd like to do is try my own effort at synthesis and get a big picture, try a little bit of a global view, but instead of going east-west from Europe to North America, I'll go north-south from the temperate to the tropics. And the argument is that the body plan of an insect group really dictates how they will behave wherever they go. It will even dictate where they go during an adaptive radiation. And it will dictate how they behave, whether they are in temperate or tropical environments. And it runs counter to the old arguments about tropical insects evolving different life histories from temperate insects. What I'm arguing is insects with the same body plan will have basically the same ecology in terms of distribution, abundance, and population dynamics. So in order to do this, I need to go to my pet insect, Eura lasiolepis. I can't quite find that pointer. Oh, here it is in front of my face. So I'm going to compare these kinds of insects, the sawflies. Can you see that? I can't. Oh, there it is. Okay, so gall-forming sawflies here, free-feeding sawflies here, a gall stem-galling sawfly, which is my pet insect, versus forest Lepidoptera. So this is looking at very different ground plans and seeing where they lead us in terms of population dynamics, distribution, abundance, and adaptive radiation around the world. When we look at the phylogeny of the early Hymenoptera, we see that from the beginning here, they are phytophagous. And right through all this radiation of the sawflies, the tenthredinidae, which I'll be talking mostly about, They have retained an intimate relationship with the host plant. They've retained the original saw-like ovipositor. And so this is what I call a phylogenetic constraint that has constrained that whole radiation to a tight association with the host plant. And of course, the Hymenoptera are radiated into other kinds of species like wasps, bees, and ants, but they kept that ovipositor and used it in their own defense as a sting. The phylogeny of the Lepidoptera is totally different. We have this original ground plan being related to detritivory. That means that they're associating with dead plant parts. They have lost the ovipositor, and they simply have an oviparous, a little floppy pad that they plop eggs down onto almost any substrate. And you see that detritivory has evolved over and over again, these brown areas in various lineages. So there's a fundamental ground plan difference between these groups, and I hope I can convince you that they have fundamentally different results in terms of population dynamics and adaptive radiation. This is the evolution of the ovipositor in insects. We have the holometabolous ground plan here. What you see in the Hymenoptera, they've retained that ovipositor, well developed, but as soon as you get into the panorpoids, to which the Lepidoptera belong, the ovipositor is gone. And what you have is a oviparous, and I'll show you that when I get to the Lepidoptera. But I want to talk about the sawfly example. Here we have a leaf-galling sawfly. The female lays an egg very carefully, precisely into the host leaf. She's probably specific to one host plant species, and the larva feeds within a gall. There's a very intimate relationship between the plant and the insect. This is the species that I've worked with, Eura lazyolepis. It's a stem galler on Salix lazyolepis. And these sawflies have a beautiful ovipositor, hence the name sawfly. It's a saw-like, annulated, flexible ovipositor where the female can lay an egg precisely one at a time. So the mother pays a lot of attention to where she lays the egg. There are receptors on the end of the ovipositor so that she can actually make decisions about the internal quality of the host plant. And while she might stimulate a gall, she is likely to reject laying an egg because the quality of the plant is not adequate. So she's making decisions based on internal information from the host plant. And some of the decisions relate to phenolic glucosides. This is the range of phenolics in this Salix lazyolepis, and there's only one to which she responds by overposition probing. And as tremulacin increases in concentration, so her response increases. This gives her a clue to the host plant and to the shoot that she's overpositing on, because the longer the shoot, the higher the tremulacin content. So whereas we think of phenolics as defenses, these are overposition stimulants for these specialized insects. And she's getting information then about the quality of resources for the larvae. She lays very precisely behind the growing point of a willow shoot, and you can see here the scar of the ovipositor. This is the egg here, placed exactly against the developing xylem vessels, which will supply water to the egg. All sawflies absorb water from the host plant, are showing again a very intimate relationship between the two. And the females are very selective on shoot length. This is the available shoot distribution on a willow clone. Long shoots are rare in a population of willows, but the sawflies show a strong preference to the longest possible shoots. This immediately sets a low carrying capacity for the population because shoots are rare, suitable shoots are rare. Suitable shoots are patchy in wetter places, so it means that populations over a landscape will be low, they'll be patchy, and we probably won't see any eruptive population dynamics because the carrying capacity sets a strong limit to population size. The reason for this preference, overpositional preference for long shoots, is because larvae survive much better there, and females then have evolved to be highly selective for long shoots. If we provide high quality plants supplied with lots of water versus low quality plants, the females in the high water content plants will form 100 galls from the potential 100 eggs that they have in an experiment. They will lay 75 eggs, and only 13.6 of those percent will die as larvae. Whereas on the low quality plants, she will not even form galls, so 62% of her potential gall formation is lost, and she won't lay eggs in another large percentage. So only 15 eggs out of 100 are laid, and of those, 54% will die on a poor quality plant. So clearly, selection is very strong for a very high overpositional preference among females, and this is linked then to high larval performance. So where you have this ground plan of an ovipositor with information from the host plant, you develop this high overpositional preference larval performance linkage, which results in patchy distributions, low populations, and what I call latent population dynamics. And the whole radiation of these tenthredinid sawflies are very much tied to the Salicaceae, one family of plants. The gall formers certainly are only found on the Salicaceae. Other nematines have gone off onto other lineages, but they're still very much tied to Salicaceae as the original group on which they've radiated. And through all these different types of gall formers, they've all stayed on the Salicaceae, showing high specificity. And this means that during adaptive radiation, they've radiated in the north temperate, where the Salicaceae are a major component of the flora. The Salicaceae have hardly gone south of the equator. We only see these sawflies on introduced plants from the northern hemisphere. Going to the Lepidoptera then, by contrast, it's a totally different picture. There's no ovipositor. Most of the Lepidoptera in these Dytrysian types. And what you see then is this little pad, the oviparous, used for planting eggs on surfaces. There's usually no penetration organ in the Lepidoptera. This is a picture of a forest tent caterpillar from snodgrass, which you all love and repeatedly read, I'm sure. But a little pad that gives the moth very, very little information. And what you see then is, like the winter moth, the female is flightless. So in the winter time, she'll climb anything that she can find. That's a tree trunk of any species she can find. It could be a hut wall, or it could be a trouser leg. And if she does decide to lay eggs, then she'll lay them many months before the larvae will emerge and feed. So she cannot evaluate the the quality of the leaves. She cannot evaluate the species of the tree that she's laying on, and therefore she can't show any overpositional preference for high quality foliage for her larvae. This means that when these geometric caterpillars, inchworms, emerge, they have evolved to be very generalized in what they can feed on. They can feed on a wide variety of host plants, and this means that the whole canopy of a forest sets the carrying capacity at a very high density. They can be highly eruptive species then, and they can spread around the world to many different kinds of trees because they are not specific in their information that they get from the host plant. Another example from Europe is the pine looper moth, and you see all these eggs lined up where the female hasn't paid any attention to placing one egg at a time in a preferable place. And what you see then is repeatedly outbreaks in Germany, where this data set is 88 years long, and synchrony over widely separated parts of the pine forest in Germany. And if you look at the population dynamics of the pine looper moth, what you see is eruptions over five orders of magnitude in these kinds of moths. And I've plotted synchronously my data of the Eura lazulipis sawfly. And what you see is variation over about two orders of magnitude. So this is what I call latent population dynamics. This is eruptive population dynamics. And I think these very large differences go back to the ground plan of these different lineages. Not only do you see eruptive dynamics, but this is over large areas. So it's very extensive, high densities, and these are the kinds of species that become pest insects. When you look at specificity too, looking at the galling sawflies, 90% of the species in Europe are known from only one or two hosts. These are Salicaceae, only one family. And in all sawflies, it's about 78% are known from only one or two hosts. When you look at moths in Europe, you'll see that the preponderance of species are up in this range of 10 to 30 host species. It's a totally different kind of specificity. And when you look at sawflies, you'll see just one relationship, one willow in the Salicaceae, one sawfly. Even with the free feeders, you'll see one host plant and another Salicaceous species in many cases. A typical geometrid moth, the purplish brown looper, you see 14 families of plants recorded as hosts, and many, many more species recorded. So these are the kinds of differences that result in very different adaptive radiations. When you look at a world map, the sawflies are largely limited to north temperate zones where the Salicaceae are distributed. When you look at moths, you'll find them all over the world, and they've moved into areas with totally different floras. And what impressed me was when you look at the list of pest forest insects in the Lepidoptera in North America, this is Nothnagel and Schultz's work, and you look at the same group in Ghana, which is Mike Wagner's book on Ghanaian forest pests, you see the same kinds of families represented as outbreaking species. This is Ghana at 5 to 11 degrees north, and you pick up a lot of these families that we're familiar with because they occur in North America as well. And there's 50% overlap in similarity, which is a highly significant similarity, whereas there's zero similarity between the host plants. So these geometrids, well, these outbreak species of Lepidoptera are able to move around the world. Because of the ground plan, they are able to move onto many different species and remain rather general in their host plant use. Just to give you an example, I'm going to compare the Mopani worm that is not in Ghana, but south in a Mopani woodland belt across Namibia to Mozambique, and the Pandora moth in North America. What you see is a wonderful insect, the Mopani worm. These are the eggs that are laid by a female. She deposits all her eggs, even on a defoliated Mopani tree, and so she's showing no preference performance kind of relationship. The larvae can eat all the foliage, so they defoliate the woodland, and they become so abundant that people gather them, native people gather them, and eat them in stews. I don't recommend the stew, although certainly protein. But the Pandora moth is behaving in the same way in North America. This happens to be in North Arizona, a photo by Mike Wagner. And again, the native people collect these and eat them as an important protein source. So what I'm arguing then is when you start with very different ground plans, you end up with very different ecological phenomena, distribution, abundance, and population dynamics. And I framed this in the phylogenetic constraints hypothesis, where you start with a phylogenetic constraint, which is some fundamental ground plan design feature like an ovipositor and the lack of an ovipositor. And then around this constraint, there'll be an adaptive syndrome that mitigates the constraint, like an ability to identify phenolic glucosides in willows by the sawflies, and being able to evaluate shoot length and so on. And then all these evolved characters in terms of the basic body plan and adaptations around that dictate what I call emergent properties. These are the heretofore unexpected results of the evolutionary background in terms of distribution, abundance, and population dynamics. So what it's saying then, it's arguing that in temperate and tropical insects with the same phylogenetic constraints, they have an evolutionarily based probability of behaving in the same way ecologically. This is against all that we learn in ecology classes about life history evolution in the tropics being very different from temperate regions. And it's very hard to test this more robustly because we know very little about population dynamics of tropical forest insects, and I certainly would like to be able to study them more myself, but that is for another life. So Bill, we can both look forward to adopting the Buddhist faith and becoming something else that enable us to study more insects in the future. Thank you very much.
We have time for a question.
Can I ask this gentleman here?
So you showed us an example of two groups that have a similar body plan with different features of the body plan resulting
Yeah, there is a problem of special pleading, but you can take the shorthorn grasshoppers, the Acridiidae, which are outbreak species all around the world, and compare those to the Tetragoniidae. and almost none of them are outbreak species except the Mormon cricket, which is an exception. And over and over again, you can take pairwise comparisons like this and see the difference. There's a difference in membracids. Membracids, the tree hoppers, are very similar to sawflies. They have a plant piercing ovipositor. You almost never see membracids listed in any group of pest insects around the world. There are a couple in Mexico, I think. And then in cercopids, a lot of cercopids are not outbreak species. But when you go to Brazil, there are a lot of cercopid species that overposit into the ground because there's a six-month dry season just outside the tropical belt. So over the summer, they are dormant in the ground. And those are all outbreak species. They're serious pests of grassland. And in my book, which is 2003, I list a lot of pairwise comparisons like that pick up the same theme of species like the acrid grasshoppers that mostly lay in the ground. There's no preference for high-quality plants, whereas tetragoniids, what little we know about them is that most of them, say in Australia, lay very precisely down the edge of the leaf, and they're selecting individual leaves to lay one or two eggs. So they show a strong overpositional preference. So I think there are a lot of examples out there.
Thank you, Peter.